The resurrection of Jesus Christ is probably one of the most vicious, wicked, heartless hoaxes ever foisted upon the minds of men and women today in the universities. Or it is the most fantastic fact of history. Jesus basically has three credentials. One is the impact of his life upon history. Second, the fulfillment of prophecy in his life. And third, the resurrection. Now listen carefully to what I'm going to say about the first 10 to 15 minutes, because to me it's one of the most important issues today. In a class on history, I usually make the statement, following the modern historical approach, I would never come to believe in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, the Savior of mankind. Following the modern historical approach, I would never believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And I would state that tonight. Following the modern historical approach, historians today, I would never come to believe in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, the Savior, and resurrected from the dead. And the reason I say it is this. The modern historical approach approaches history with these presuppositions. Now, you know what a presupposition is. It's something you think out before you actually study. Let's put it that way. Before you even start investigating, you have certain views you hold regardless of what you find. It's presupposed. Even before you start studying, you presuppose it. And a modern historical approach presupposes approximately five things. One, there is no God. There is no God. Second, we live in a closed system. In other words, there's no God on the outside the system, coming and working within the system. Everything takes place within the system. Cause and effect. There is no God. We live in a closed system. There is no supernatural. There is no supernatural. And miracles are not possible. These are four presuppositions of most historians today. There is no God. We live in a closed system. There is no supernatural, and miracles are not possible. There has to be an answer in the naturalistic perspective of history and the world. They take these views and they start to study the resurrection. And they come to something like the empty tomb. And they will dogmatically state to you in the classroom today, it could not be a resurrection. Why? A lot of them don't even realize why they say there is no resurrection. Because of their presuppositions. There is no God. We live in a closed system. There is no supernatural. Miracles are not possible. Therefore, there couldn't be a resurrection. One head of a philosophy department, after I finished speaking, he made some rather sharp statements, and a student spoke up and said, "Well, sir, what do you believe about that Easter morning? What happened?" He says, "Tell you the truth, I really can't explain it. But it wasn't a resurrection." Regardless of what the evidence was, regardless of what the facts were, he said it could not be a resurrection. Why? Because of your historical investigation? No. But your philosophical presuppositions. Modern history starts studying history with philosophical presuppositions, not historical biases. They are philosophical presuppositions. And by their philosophy, they determine the content of what they are going to find. And this is going to be more prevalent in the future. In Hastings' dictionary, under philosophical evidence, it says the ultimate reason for rejecting the resurrection evidence are not historical. As Sabatier truly says, even if the differences were perfectly reconciled, or even did not exist at all, men who will not admit the miraculous would nonetheless decisively reject the witness. In other words, if there was an absolute foolproof witness of the resurrection, they still wouldn't believe in it because they say there is no miraculous events. There are none. They find that out historically? No, philosophically. Then he goes on to say, this is his conscious, deliberate undertaking to give an explanation of the evidence on the presupposition of a certain view of the universe, like Spinoza. It has been said that he could not believe in the actual resurrection of Jesus because such belief would have compelled him to abandon his theory of the universe, that we live in a naturalistic universe. And because of his theory of living in a naturalistic universe, he says, I can't believe in a resurrection, regardless of what the facts are. Dr. Bernard Ram, in the existential interpretation of the resurrection, from the philosophical perspective, says, unbelief now is a task of deciding what is historical and what is not. If it boldly says everything supernatural and theological about Jesus must go, then synoptic criticism become artificial, dogmatic, and naturalistic. And this is what they say. Everything supernatural about Jesus must go. Why? Because of the evidence? No. Because we live in a closed system. There is no God. There is no supernatural. There is no miraculous. So there could be supernatural, so it has to be unhistorical. As Dr. Ram points out, before criticism actually begins, the supernatural is ruled out. A conclusion dictated dogmatically by anti-supernatural metaphysics. On what other basis could critics completely rule out the supernatural in a document that admittedly has historical value, like the New Testament? The only way they can do it is with their philosophical presuppositions. Boltman. Whenever Boltman denies the historical worth of a passage because of the supernatural content, he has ceased to be an historian evaluating sources. But he'll say, this passage cannot be historical. Why? It has a supernatural in it. And we know there is no God. We live in a closed system. There is no supernatural, and there is no such a thing as a miracle. So it has to be unhistorical. Dr. Clark Pinnock puts it this way. Most modern unbelievers are not interested in the evidence for or against the resurrection, even if the evidence is quite compelling. But every investigator interprets his facts within a philosophical framework. Only those events have significance which fit in with the empirical universe, excluding God and the supernatural. Therefore, even if probable, the resurrection would be such an odd, inexplicable occurrence that it would be absurd to a secular historian today. Why? Well, very simple, it would be absurd because we know there is no God. We live in a closed system. There is no supernatural. Miracles are not possible. So there couldn't be a resurrection. Even before they start studying the evidence, they rule it out with their philosophical biases. Dr. J.N.D. Anderson, he is the professor of Islamic studies, Islamic law at the University of London Law School. He's a dean of advanced legal studies. He is the foremost scholar and authority on Islamic law in the world. And he says it can be asserted with confidence that men and women disbelieve the Easter story not because of the evidence, but in spite of it. It is not that they weigh the evidence with open minds, assess its relevance and cogency, and finally decide that it is suspect or inadequate. Instead, they start with an a priori, in other words, presupposed, an a priori conviction that the resurrection of Christ would constitute such an incredible event that it could not be accepted or believed without scientific demonstration of an irrefutable nature. But it is idle to demand proof of this sort for any event in history. Historical evidence from its very nature can never amount to more than a very high degree of probability. It is on such evidence that virtually all our knowledge of the past depends. Now get this straight. A lot of problems that people have is not with the evidence. It's with their philosophical framework. And once you point that out to them, you're on a better footing. They rule it out because of presuppositions, not because of the evidence of history. As Dr. John Warrett Montgomery says, the only way we can know whether an event can occur is to see whether, in fact, it has occurred. The problem of miracles, then, must be solved in the realm of historical investigation, not in the realm of philosophical speculation. Like one historian I was reading, he said the resurrection can't be true because in other myths, you have resurrections, and there the resurrection is a myth. And it fits into the same category, so therefore the resurrection of Jesus Christ is a myth without ever investigating the evidence. You can't do that. When I find something like that, immediately in my mind when I study history, a red light comes on and says, stop, suspect. Whenever something does fit into a myth of another type of religion or anything, then a red light comes on, suspect. But then I must become critical and investigate it further. So be very careful. But the ones you are talking with and sharing with, they're not ruling out the resurrection on philosophical presuppositions. Now, Christianity is diametrically opposed to almost all your other major religions. Almost all your other religions are based upon philosophical propositions or theological ideologies. Christianity was built upon the life, death, and resurrection of its founder. Other religious teachers have put their teachings out in front and themselves in the background. Jesus put himself out in front and his teachings in the background, you might say. And it's the only one that appeals to the resurrection of its founder for substantiating the truth of what has been said. As Paul said, if Christ not be raised from the dead, then our faith is in vain. When I was in Uruguay, a Mohammedan student came to me. Says, ah, you poor Christians. He says, we go to the tomb of our master, we have his body. You go to your tomb and you... I said, that's right, it's empty. And at that moment, he discovered a tremendous theological and historical truth. That tomb was empty. And it was so funny, I wish I'd had it on film. His face just dropped. He says, you go to the tomb of your master and it's empty. Everything Jesus taught, lived, and died for depended on one thing, his resurrection. The resurrection of Jesus Christ in Christianity stands or falls together. A student came to me at the University of Uruguay, Montevideo, South America. Said, Mr. McDowell, why can't you rationalistically, intellectually reject the Christian faith? I said, for one simple reason. I am not able to explain away an event in time, space, dimension, history. The resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now I use the phrase time, space, dimension, history. Time, it was a third day. Space, it was a tomb. If you'd have been at the crucifixion of Jesus and rubbed your hand over the cross, you'd gotten a sliver. It happened in time. There was material there. It's not something removed from history. If that stone had been rolled in your foot, you'd been a cast for 3 months. Time, space, dimension, history. This is why Dr. J. Gresham Machen said that Christianity is not built upon a complex of ideas, but upon an historical event, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now tonight I'd like to take the perspective, you might say, of the legal or historical approach to it. The resurrection. Let me read to you what this approach would be. One is quoting Dr. Ethelbert Stauffer, S-T-A-U-F-F-E-R, in his book Jesus and His History. He is an Erlangen historian. He says, quote, what do we, as historians do, when we experience surprises which run counter to all our expectations, perhaps all our convictions, and even our period's whole understanding of truth? We say, as one great historian used to say in such instances, it is surely possible, and why not? For the critical historian, nothing is impossible. Dr. Philip Shaw, the historian, says this, the purpose of the historian is not to construct a history from preconceived notions and to adjust it to his own liking, but to reproduce it from the best evidence and let it speak for itself. In other words, we need to go to the evidence, to the events, and let them fall into place and not put them into place according to preconceived notions, whether pro or con. And boy, you have to be careful there. With your preconceived notions, you've got to be honest with yourself. For example, a person who denies God's existence will not subscribe to belief in the Bible. Regardless of the reliability, accuracy, inspiration of the Bible, why? He will not subscribe to it. Why? Because he says there is no God. Regardless of what the evidence is. A Muslim convinced that God cannot beget will not accept as the Word of God a book that teaches that Christ is the only begotten Son of God because of his preconceived notion. Still others hold that God cannot communicate his truth undistorted through sinful men. Hence, they regard the Bible as at least in parts no more than human. Because they say, well look, there's no way God could communicate to man without error because of man. Therefore, the Bible has to be in error regardless of what the evidence is. So let's be very careful as we approach the evidence for the resurrection and let it fall into place and see what happens. There was a man that made our country, one of the law schools in our country, quite famous. His name was Dr. Simon Greenleaf. He was one of the greatest lawyers we ever had. When I was in law school, he was my hero. And from the legal perspective, before I share what he did and some other lawyers, I need to point something out. This is in the area of circumstantial evidences. If enough people are alive, When the facts are published, or information is published about an event, and these people were either eyewitnesses of the event or had participated in it, it can be fairly well established the validity of a secular event. You see what I'm saying? Say an event takes place, and all of you were eyewitnesses of it, or participated in it. Tonight, say someone gets shot. And then in 2 weeks, all the information is compiled and printed. Now, if enough people are alive who were here tonight and observed the event or had participated in it, then through that published document and the witnesses, it can be pretty well established the validity of an event that took place. Now, Dr. Simon Greenleaf wrote the 3 volumes in the Laws of Legal Evidence. You ought to check out who was who to see who he was. He was quite a man. He was a skeptic, always mocking the Christians in his law classes at Harvard. Many of his students challenged him to take the 3 volumes in the Laws of Legal Evidence and to apply to the resurrection of Christ. I thought that was a pretty good challenge. He did that. In the process, he became a Christian. He went on to write a book. It's about this thick, printed by Baker Bookhouse. And he comes to the conclusion that the resurrection of Jesus Christ is one of the best established facts of history, according to the rules of evidence administered in the courts of justice. There were 2 men at Cambridge, Lord Lyttelton and Benjamin Gilbert West. They were fed up with the Christian faith. They wanted to give the fatal blow to destroy it. I wish more people would set out to refute Christianity. We'd have more Christians. And they wanted to give the fatal blow to destroy it. So they knew they had to destroy 2 things. One, the conversion of Saul of Tarsus. I know many professors become Christians through the conversion of Saul of Tarsus. And I'll be speaking about that tomorrow morning. Second, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. So they wanted to write a book together to refute the myth of Christianity. Lord Lyttelton chose the conversion of Saul of Tarsus and Dr. Benjamin Gilbert West because they knew that these 2 things would give the fatal blow to Christianity. They took their leave of absence and went their own individual way to do their study and research, and when they came back, they were a little sheepish to share their findings. Because each one, independently, had come to the exact opposite conclusion of what he set out to prove and become an ardent follower of Jesus Christ. And he went on to write a book called Observations of the Evidence and the History for the Resurrection. And on the flyleaf, Dr. West had printed a saying similar to this: reject not until you have examined the evidence. There was a man that wrote under the name of Dr. Frank Morrison. He was a journalist and an engineer with some training in law. He thought the lifestyle of Jesus Christ was the heaviest lifestyle ever lived. But when he got to the resurrection, he thought somebody come along and tacked on a myth, and it kind of got him out of fellowship. And so he wanted to write a book to refute the myth of the resurrection. So he started gathering information and was so sincere in doing it, he took his own money and went to Palestine to do part of his research. While he was there, he committed his life to Jesus Christ. He went on to write a book that's out in paperback called Who Moved the Stone? And the first chapter is significantly titled, The Book That Refused to be Written. What did these men find? What did men like Dr. Thomas Arnold, the famous historian, wrote the 2 famous volumes in the history of Rome? What caused him to change his mind and come to the conclusion that there's probably no event of ancient history better attested by evidence than the resurrection of Jesus Christ? Well, it was these men approached the resurrection to check out what took place. And finally, the evidence drove them to Christianity. Like C.S. Lewis said, I was one of the most reluctant men ever to become a Christian. He said, I was driven into the kingdom kicking. But he did it because of the evidence. Now let us start looking in detail at some of this evidence. I want to make 2 lists, side by side. I'll go through one, and then I'll come back and go through the other side of it. On the left column, we'll put before. And the right column will put after. The evidence for the resurrection. First of all, Christ's predictions. Christ's predictions before that first Easter. In Matthew 16:21. From that time, Jesus Christ began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised up on the 3rd day. Matthew 17:9 says, And as they were coming down from the mountain, Jesus commanded them, saying, Tell the vision to no one until the Son of Man has risen from the dead. Mark 9:10. And they used that statement, discussing with one another what rising from the dead might mean. Luke 9:22-27. The Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed and be raised up on the third day. And then you have John 2:19-22. John 12:34. And then evidence that demands a verdict will give you a lot more of them. Over and over again, Jesus prognosticated that he would be raised from the dead. He said, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I'll raise it back up again. And they brought that out at the trial. And he made that statement. Jesus was going up to Jerusalem, to the Jerusalem 1 conspiracy trial. And the disciples said, don't go up there, they're going to kill you. And Jesus said, men, you don't understand. And tomorrow I will tell you why. In the morning they didn't understand. It was because of their concept of the Messiah. As we look at the conversion of the apostles in the morning, see the uniqueness of their concept of the Messiah and being changed just like that. He said, men, you don't understand. He said, I must go to Jerusalem, go through the mockery of the trial, be spit upon, be crucified and buried, but in the third day I'll be raised from the dead. Even his enemies understood it. And actually his enemies understood it before his friends did, which is rather unique. In Matthew 27, the Jewish rabbis went over to the Roman leader and said, look, when that deceiver was still alive, he said after 3 days he'd be raised from the dead. We better make that grave secure, or the second deception will be greater than the first. Christ predicted it. Second, Christ was dead. Christ was dead. The eyewitness accounts say that when the spear was thrust into the side of Jesus, that water and blood came out separated. Even a nurse can tell you that is a sign of death. An evidence that demands a verdict, which you'll be reading in the next 2 days, goes into detail quoting medical sources on how Christ died and the significance of the account saying that water and blood came out separated. Four executioners signed his death warrant. Very few people could ever even be put on the cross for a short time and taken down and live. There's one account where three men were crucified, and a very well thought of man talked the Roman emperor or the governor in just a matter of an hour and a half to 2 hours to take two of the men down, or all three of them. And they took all three of them down, and two of them died from it. And they were only up there a short time. The reason was the agony and the pain of crucifixion. Now, if Judea were not a Roman province, Jesus would have been executed by stoning. But about the time that Jesus was presented in the temple to be dedicated, what was it, 12 years old? At that time, the death penalty was taken away from the Jews. The death penalty was taken away from the Jews. And from then on, it was by crucifixion. If it had been Jewish authority, he'd have been stoned to death. But the law of the sword, the right to execute capital punishment, was now reserved for the Roman governor of Judea, Pontius Pilate, who would have to review the Sanhedrin's verdict and then make up his own mind. Now, some writers have doubted that victims were ever nailed to a cross. Even though it says that Jesus had the wounds right in his hands, Thomas put his fingers into his wounds, a lot of authorities say that the victims were never nailed to the cross, claiming that spikes would have torn through their flesh and failed to support them. This has been held by many scholars. But in 1968, the archaeologist V. Zafiris, T-Z-A-F-E-R-I-S, T-Z-A-F-E-R-I-S, excavated some stone tablets in East Jerusalem dating from the 1st century A.D. and burial places, going all the way back to the 1st century. These were chests in which bones of the dead were reburied after the flesh had decomposed following original burial in a cave. One of these containers, inscribed with the name Yohanan ben Hagalgol, H-A-G-A-L-G-O-L, contained the bones of a man who had obviously been crucified, the first such victim ever discovered. A large rusty spike, 7 inches long, had been driven through both heel bones after his first penetration penetrating the acacia wood wedge or plaque that held the ankles firmly to the cross. The nail, this account says, must have encountered a knot being driven into the cross, for the point of the spike had been bent directly backwards. Slivers still clinging to it show that the cross was made of olive wood. And here were these scholars for years saying that no one was ever crucified with a nail in 1968. They found it even with the slivers of the wood in it. You know, it comes to Pilate. A lot of them said that Pilate really wasn't a historical figure for quite a while. And the reason is, there had never been any archaeological discovery confirming the existence of Pilate. And even doubted Pilate being the Roman governor and taking care of the trial of Jesus. And then in 1961, an Italian archaeologist excavating an ancient theater at Caesarea, which was a Mediterranean port that served the Roman capital of Palestine, unearthed a 2-by-3-foot stone that bore some inscriptions on it. And one inscription in English reads, Pontius Pilate, governor of Judea, has presented the Tiberium to the Caesareans. The Tiberium must have been some kind of a public structure or something that he had presented. And right there, archaeology, 1961, dug it up. It had the name Pontius Pilate. And it was the first ever discovered on the existence of Pilate. Christ was dead. Third, the tomb. The Jewish tombs had an entrance about 4.5 to 5 feet. About 4.5 to 5 feet. This is why when the women panicked, they went back and told the men. It says Peter and John came running to the tomb, and John got there first. And it says that John did not go in. He leaned over, and the reason he leaned over is only 4.5 to 5 foot tall. He wasn't dumb. He didn't want a headache. And the Jewish tombs had an entrance about 4.5 to 5 feet tall. On the inside, there were places for 3 cadavers. One in the left, one in the front, and one in the right, with the head often protruding into the wall of 8.5 to 11 inches. And sometimes it would have the shoulders a little elevated. A solid rock tomb with one entrance about 4.5 to 5 feet tall. Fourth situation before the resurrection. The great clothes. John in John 19 and 20 brings out that Christ was buried according to the burial customs of the Jews. And it says that more than 100 pounds of aromatic spices were used. You say, now come on, that's a lot of spices. Make a lot of tea. Well, it would. But 100 pounds really wasn't something out of the ordinary for a great man. For example, Gamaliel, who was a contemporary of Jesus, Saul of Tarsus studied under him. Gamaliel was a grandson of the great Jewish scholar Hillel, born in Babylon. When Gamaliel died, they used 86 pounds of spices in his burial. So 100 pounds wasn't really something out of the ordinary. When Herod died, it took 500 servants to carry the spices. So 100 pounds wasn't any big deal. And what they do is take the body, place it on a stone slab. They would straighten all the members. They would take the aromatic spices and mix in with it a gummy consistency. And then they'd take a piece of linen cloth about 30 centimeters wide, and they'd start to wrap the body. And they start at the feet, wrap up to the armpits, put the arms down, start below the fingers, wrap up to the neck, and a separate piece around the head. So it'd form an encasement around the body, in this situation, probably about 115 to 118 pounds around the body. The grave clothes. Fifth, the stone. The stone. Matthew says a large stone. Mark 16 says an extremely large stone. Now that word extremely large, that phrase there in our language would be saying the university kind of be, man, get a load of that rock! Now how large was an extremely large get a load of that rock stone? Well, Dr. Frank Morrison, who wrote the book Who Moved the Stone, calculated the size of the stone as an engineer needed to row against a 4.5 to 5 foot doorway, said it would have to weigh from 1.5 to 2 tons. In the Bezae manuscripts, B-E-Z-A-E, the Bezae manuscripts, some of the oldest manuscripts we have, in the Mark 16 portion, it says, within the text, within parentheses, a stone, parentheses, that could not be moved by 20 men. Now what's the significance of that? Well, in the rules of transcribing a manuscript, if the transcriber was putting in his own thoughts or the thought of his day, he would make a marginal note. But if he was copying a marginal note of the original manuscript or the thought of the day of the original manuscript, they would often put it within the text within parentheses. In this phrase, a stone that could not be moved by 20 men must have come from a manuscript within a few years of the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Several professors at Georgia Tech, geologists, when they were in Palestine, calculated the size of the stone needed to row against a doorway, and they calculated the type of stone that was used in the day of Christ. And they wrote me a letter on it. And they had it all worked out mathematically, the whole bit. I couldn't understand any of it, just a conclusion in English. And said, we have come to the conclusion that it would have to weigh almost 2 tons. No wonder they said, an extremely large stone. Next precaution, a guard. A guard. The Jewish leaders went over and said to Pilate, said, look, when that deceiver is still alive, he said after 3 days he'd be raised from the dead. We better make that grave secure before the second deception is greater than the first. So Pilate said, a guard you have, now go make it secure. Now a lot of people reading through there would say, well, what Pilate actually said was, look, you've got your temple police, you take your temple police and go make it secure if you want to. Now I don't believe it was a temple police at all. Not at all, but if you want to say it is, okay. In this chapter in the resurrection evidence that demands a verdict, it documents who and what a temple policeman was. And they were like green berets. If a temple policeman was caught asleep, he was automatically burned alive, his own clothes set afire. They were strict. Now I believe it was a Roman guard. Because it basically can be an imperative there when it says, a guard you have, now go. It'd be like the fellow down here would say, I need a pencil to write with. I say, okay, a pen you have, now write. A guard you have, go. Let me tell you, they were having problems. The Romans and the Jews had a lot of problems with Jesus Christ. And both of them had to do something about it. In fact, the Jews, more than even the Romans, could not afford a deception. For various reasons. One, political reasons. The Jews had been rebelling, and the Romans were getting fed up with it. Almost every Roman governor was losing his head over the Jews. And the Jews could not afford a political revolt. So they had political reasons for making sure that grave was secure. Second, they had religious reasons. Thousands of Jews were turning to Christ. And so they had to do something from the religious perspective. Third, they had personal reasons. Boy, Jesus was chewing them up and spitting them out. You whitewashed sepulchers. He was undermining their religious authority. He said, by your traditions, you're making the word of God of none effect. And he was a personal threat to him, so there were personal reasons why they had to make sure that grave was secure. And then, of course, there were economic reasons. Not only were thousands turning away from Judaism, there went a lot of the coins. But Jesus was driving them out of the temple. So there were political, religious, personal, and economic reasons for making sure that grave was secure. I believe it was a Roman guard for various reasons. One, because of the word used there, custodia. It comes down to us through the Latin custodia, and today we have the English word custodian, but it's changed quite a bit. Quite a bit. Doesn't mean somebody's sweeping out the graves. It was used in the Oxyrhynchus papyri for the Roman guard. And the word custodian, I documented it ethnologically in this chapter in my book, was a word used, a very unique word used by the Romans for the guard. The Roman guard unit. You can check men like Flavius Vigilius Renatus. He was a man that lived several hundred years after Christ. He was a military historian, and he wrote a manual to the Roman emperor recommending that he instill the methods of offensive and defensive warfare of the Romans at the time of Christ, because the Roman army was starting to dissipate. And he knew the Roman Empire would be destroyed if it did not instill the methods of offensive warfare that the Romans used to have. So he wrote a manual called the Military Institutes of the Romans. These methods that he records of the guard units and everything were so good that our government used them, many of them, to train the Green Berets that fought in Vietnam. You can check out the Military Classic series in Congressional Library or in my own library. I finally got a hold of a copy. It's mighty hard to come by. And in there he talks about the discipline of the Roman guard. I mean, the enemy feared the Roman guard. T.L. Tucker, in his book, Roman Life in the Times of Nero and St. Paul, describes what the Roman guard is. It's all documented in this chapter in my book. And it literally comes out and says it's a fighting machine. There were anywhere from 4 to 20 men. Now, usually the guard unit was 16. 16 men, each trained to protect 6 square feet of ground. The 16 men, squares of 4 on each side, could protect 36 square yards of ground against the entire invading army. Now, what they would often do is sleep in shifts. And they would change shifts every 3 hours, so they'd always be alert. In other words, whatever they were guarding, 8 men would be asleep right around the 4 men that were stationed there. And then every 3 hours they switched. So everybody got up to 8 hours sleep. And he would be fresh. And he carried something like 5 different weapons on him. You see some of these supercilious pictures of the tomb of Jesus Christ, a couple men standing around, wooden spears and miniskirts on. Well, that's about the last thing that took place. It was a fighting machine that was put there. And if you don't believe it was a Roman guard, then check out who the temple police were. Also, in Matthew 28, it says, after the resurrection took place, that some of the guards, now see there it even points out it's a multi-man unit, it says some of the guards came into the high priest. You say, look, came to the high priest. So it shows it had to be the temple police. No, read the context. The high priest said, if you'll take this money and spread abroad that while you were sleeping, the disciples tiptoed in and stole the body. If you would do that and take this money, then when it comes to the governor's ears, the Roman governor's ears will keep you from being cut off or killed. The reason they went to the Jewish high priest is that they knew the Jews had influence with the Romans. And it was the only way to save their neck, and even then I don't think they saved their neck. Otherwise that passage wouldn't even make sense if it was a temple police. After the guard, you have the seal, 7. A.T. Robertson, one of the greatest Greek scholars that ever lived, his grammar is only about that thick. If you ever dropped it, it'd break your leg. He said that this guard could only be the Roman guard, and he said the seal was put on in the presence of the Roman guard. Vigidius brings out the same thing. That the guard was put on, they would examine the premise and then seal it. And then they were to protect that seal because that seal stood for the power and authority of the Roman Empire. The seal was usually made up of 2 pieces of rawhide. Piece going from one side to the other and from top to the bottom. 4 clay packs on the outside with a large clay pack in the center with a Roman seal in it. Which literally stood for the power and authority of the Roman Empire. Next, you have the apostles. The apostles. They were discouraged. They were defeated. And Peter went out and denied Christ 3 times. Actually, 6 times. 3 times and the cock crowed once, and then 3 more times and the cock crowed twice. 6 denials. 2 sets of 3 each. They were whipped. They were defeated. They went each one and hid themselves in their own home. They were cowards. And then 9, you have worship. They worshiped on the 7th day. Worshiped on the 7th day. Now, let's take a break here. And what I'm going to do is come back and go take all these things in a parallel column and show the scene after that Easter morning and show what happened. And I think as we do this, you're going to start getting the impact of the situation that first Easter morning. We made a list of 8 things that were in existence or took place before that first Easter morning. Christ predicted his resurrection over and over again. He was dead. He was crucified. We talked about his tomb, the grave clothes, the stone, the guard, the seal, the apostles, and worship was on the 7th day. Now something happened. Something happened 2,000 years ago that literally changed the course of history. Something happened that took 12 men, turned their lives upside down, all but one went out and died a martyr's death. Some of the most heinous deaths that a man could face, you can read the Encyclopedia Britannica. All for one thing, an empty tomb and the appearances of a man by the name of Jesus of Nazareth. Something happened that has caused more books to be written about that event than any other event in history. As far as I can tell, the resurrection. Something happened that this world has never gotten over it, even changed the dates in textbooks. 1973 AD, the Latin Anno Domini, the year of the Lord. Now there's a lot of theories around to show that the resurrection of Jesus Christ was a fraud. You ought to study every single one of them. Because the more you study, the way people try to explain away what happened, the greater your convictions become in the resurrection. I probably got greater convictions about the resurrection through reading those that tried to refute it and explain different theories than I did just looking at the evidence. Because you see how shallow it is. The historian becomes anti-historical. The philosopher anti-philosophical. Now there's one good theory to show that the resurrection was a fraud. Now I think some of these men that came up with some of these theories must have had two brains. One was lost and the other was out looking for it. I'm serious. They come up with some of the things they've come up with. But here is one theory. We'll discuss a few more of them later. It's recorded in Matthew 28. Now the Bible says, first of all, this is what took place. There was a great earthquake. An angel of the Lord came, rolled the stone away. The guard fell as dead. Now let me tell you, for that guard to fall as dead, it really had to be something startling, a little more than an angel with a couple wings. The guard fell as dead, and the stone was rolled away. Now, God didn't roll the stone away so Jesus could come out. Rolled the stone away so we could go in and see the tomb was empty. God never leaves a stone unturned. Now, here was a theory. Here was a theory set forth. Soldiers, some of them ran into the high priest. And the high priest said, okay, you take this money, spread abroad, that way you were sleeping. The disciples, you know, kind of tiptoed through the tulips, stole the body, became part of the bod squad, spread abroad, that while you were sleeping, the disciples stole the body. When it comes to the governor's ears, we'll keep you from being killed. In other words, this theory says that the disciples stole the body. Now, whether you accept that theory or any other theory, there's certain things you must explain away. And let's explain these and look at these things in making parallel columns we did in the first lecture. From Christ's predictions about the resurrection, we go afterwards to the apostles' proclamation of the resurrection. From Christ's prediction to the apostles' proclamation, looking back. Christ looked forward, the apostles didn't look back. I'd like you to do this sometime. Take and breeze through the book of Acts. Put your speed reading course to use in the book of Acts. And just go down through the book of Acts real fast and start making notations or little asterisks along the way when the apostles appealed to the resurrection that they were eyewitnesses. It's amazing. All the way through. Just one right after another. We were eyewitnesses. We were eyewitnesses. That which we saw God do, etc., etc., etc. All the way through the book of Acts. Their proclamation was that Jesus Christ was raised from the dead. Boy, in Acts 1, verse 3, it says to these, the apostles, he also presented himself alive after his suffering by many convincing proofs, appearing to them over a period of 40 days. Now, the phrase there, convincing proofs, was a term used in law courts. Evidence, legal evidence was presented. Then we have Christ was dead. When parallel to that, we have all the appearances. All the appearances. And in evidence that demands a verdict, pages 233 and 234 have a list of all the appearances. To Mary Magdalene, to the women returning from the tomb, to Peter later in the day, to the Emmaus disciples, to the apostles when Thomas wasn't there, to the apostles when Tom was there, to James, to the multitude of more than 500 at one time. In 56 A.D., the apostle Paul wrote, 1 Corinthians 15 said that Jesus appeared to more than 500 people at one time, and the majority of them are alive today and can confirm it. He threw the case right out before the world and says, go check it out for yourself. Appearances to Paul, to Stephens, to John, to the 11, to the 7 by the lake of Tiberias. Jesus appeared alive. They walked with him, they talked with him, and they quoted precious verses from the Old Testament as Jesus proclaimed to them things about himself. Look at Thomas. Here conceivably, Thomas was out, you know, trying to shape a new life for himself. After 3 years, the whole thing was a mess. His hero, his life, everything down the tubes. So Thomas tubed out. And I'm sure Thomas was out looking for a job or putting in for Roman unemployment. I'm sure. And then they come to Thomas. They said, look, Thomas, Jesus is alive. We saw him. He appeared to us. You know, a lot of people criticize Thomas. But I kind of applaud Thomas. He demanded empirical proof. Thomas's was kind of a scientific challenge to Christ. A demand for direct and objective evidence, not hearsay. It was just the opposite. He wanted direct, objective evidence. And I'm so glad Thomas was there. He was from Berkeley. He said, I won't believe unless I put my fingers in his wounds. And Thomas went out and died a martyr's death. Jesus was alive to Thomas. It wasn't some ghost. I took a handkerchief and wiped the blood off and hadn't caked it. Jesus was alive. Next, the tomb. The tomb was empty. The tomb was empty. Even the enemies ascribed to the empty tomb. They took the apostles, they beat them, they flogged them and said, if you don't stop propagating this that Jesus Christ is alive from the dead, we're going to put you to death. And that tomb had been empty because, you see, just a 15-minute walk by any Roman secretary on her lunch break could confirm the tomb, whether it was empty or full. Because, you see, they went right back to Jerusalem and proclaimed the resurrection. They didn't go tripping off to Athens or Caesarea or some other place. No, they went right back to Jerusalem. Some months after the resurrection, the authorities were desperate to stop this movement. They had to turn to persecution. And all they'd had to done is gone to the tomb and taken the body and showed it. The women came. They saw the tomb. They sat there and saw Jesus buried, saw him put in that tomb. It wasn't some big cemetery. It was a private cemetery. And they went back there, and it was empty. The tomb was empty. Dr. Paul Meyer, professor of ancient history at Western Michigan University, in his book, The First Easter, The True and Unfamiliar Story, and I recommend that book. It's novel form. It just flows along. It is beautiful to read. But it says, if all the evidence is weighed carefully, he's speaking as an historian here, and fairly, it is indeed justifiable, according to the canons of historical research, to conclude that the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea, in which Jesus was buried, was actually empty on the morning of the first Easter. And no shred of evidence has yet been discovered in literary sources or archaeology that would disprove this statement. That tomb was empty. Next, the grave clothes. The tomb wasn't empty. Peter and John ran to the tomb. John got there and leaned over. Remember, 4.5 feet tall, didn't want a headache. He leaned over and he looked in. And he looked over where the body of Christ had been placed. And there were the grave clothes. Sort of in the formation of the body, caved in a little, the headpiece right where the head was, but empty. The body of Christ had passed right through it into a new existence. And let's face it, that kind of make you a hot shot believer for the moment. Passed right through to a new existence. The tomb wasn't empty. The grave clothes were there. The grave clothes were empty. Fifth, the stone. The stone was moved. 1.5 to 2 stone, and one account said that 20 men couldn't move it. You say, come on, how'd they ever roll it against the entrance then, man? Very simple. You ever seen this? Stone, falcon, and a 2x4. One man can do the work of 20. And usually they'd have little trenches that would come down to the front. And it'd been set up ahead of time. They pull it away and it rolls down to the front of the thing. Now the stone was moved, but it was in a very unusual position that a lot of people missed studying the resurrection. Every time an account was recorded from an eyewitness, an amazing statement was made in the Greek about the position of the stone. Let me show you what I mean. Matthew says the stone was rolled against the entrance, uses a Greek word, kuleo, K-U-L-I-O, which means to roll. Now Mark used the same root word, but added a preposition, added the preposition ana, A-N-A. Ana, according to the Greek lexicons, can only mean up or upward. Ana kuleo, the two put together, can only mean to roll something up an incline or a slope. And for Mark to have used that word, and remember we saw there are extra biblical sources confirming the accuracy of Mark. For Mark to have used that word, there had to be a slope or an incline coming down to the front of that tomb. Because Greek is so specific. And in Luke, who many people consider one of the most accurate historians of antiquity, in Luke 24, this is in Mark 16 here, in Luke 24, Luke used the same root word, kuleo, but added the preposition apa, A-P-P-O, apa. Apa means away from in the sense of distance or separation. Apa kuleo means to roll one object from another object in the sense of distance. Now, they saw the stone rolled away from what? What would they roll the stone away from to steal the body? The door, the entrance, right. Now follow closely. In Mark 16, the women were coming to the tomb early Sunday morning. And they were saying, you say, now come on. Why were those silly women coming to that tomb Sunday morning if that Roman guard was there in a Roman seal? Very simple. Jesus was crucified Friday. He was buried Friday afternoon. The Roman guard was not put on until Saturday night, where they examined the premise, sealed it, and then stood guard. The women lived in a far-off suburb of Bethany. They didn't know the guard had been put on yet. And they were coming back Sunday morning. And they were saying to each other, who will roll away the stone from, and used the Greek word for the entrance of the tomb, which was logical. But when they got there, Luke records, they said, who moved the stone away from? And they changed the Greek word from the entrance to the entire massive sepulcher and used the Greek word apakuleo, mean in the sense of distance from not just the entrance, but the entire sepulcher. In fact, that stone was in such a position, up a slope away from not just the entrance, the entire sepulchre. But John in John 20 had to use a different Greek word, airo, A-I-R-O. Airo means, according to Greek lexicons like Arndt and Gingrich, means to pick up something and to carry it away. Now I ask you, men and women, if they just kind of wanted to tiptoe in, move the stone over and steal the body, why all the effort to roll 1 to 2.5 ton stone up a slope away from not just the entrance, but the entire sepulcher looking like it had been picked up and carried away? Let me tell you, that guard had to have cotton in their ears and earmuffs on not to have heard that one if they were asleep. That had been recorded on the Richter scale at Cal Poly. The position of the stone was moved up and away. Six, the guard. Here were 16 men, each trained to protect 6 square feet of ground. Placed at the tomb of Jesus. Do you know what happened when that guard unit fell asleep? Left the position? Failed in any way? Between Flavius Vigilius Renatus and the military institutes of the Romans and T.L. Tucker and the life of Rome in the time of Nero and St. Paul points out if one man failed in his duty, fell asleep or anything, he was automatically executed, but he was not the only one put to death. The entire 60-man security unit was put to death for one man's mistake. Various ways were put to death. One popular one was they were stripped of their clothes and burned alive in a fire started by their own garments. Let me tell you. Not one of those guys, let alone all of them, would have fallen asleep. They'd been up all night beating each other over the head to save it. Justin, in his digest, lists 18 things that a Roman guard unit was put to death for, and one especially brought out, I think it was number 13 in the list, was leaving a night watch. The leaving of a night watch. An immediate execution. The Roman guard, they weren't asleep. Next, the seal. The seal was broken. You know what happened when that seal was broken? The FBI, CIA, SDS, CCC, and everything else in the Roman Empire was thrown into finding that man or men. And when they were found, it was automatic execution upside down. The breaking of that Roman seal, the apostles feared the breaking of that seal. They don't fear. They were so discouraged and so defeated, they each went their own way. The breaking of the Roman seal. Next, the apostles. The transformation of the apostles. And their boldness. Transformation of the apostles and their boldness. Before the resurrection, they were discouraged. They were defeated. Peter even went out and denied Christ before a woman. Yet afterwards, in a matter of a few days, his life was transformed. And then we see him in the book of Acts standing up and proclaiming it and right in the face of death. Anything but an actual historical resurrection, anything else would have vitiated the enthusiasm that any of the apostles had left. The only thing that could have literally transformed those apostles, and I'll be talking about the apostles tomorrow and tying it up with us, The uniqueness of what happened was the resurrection. And just studying their life before and after, and here their master had been crucified. Dr. Paul Meyer says, something must have taken place on Easter morning to have ignited that spiritual explosion called Christianity. And the only thing it could have been was a resurrection. They went out and died for it, and we'll see that tomorrow. Then the apostles, on the other side here, number 9, you've got worship changed to the first day of the week. There was one Jewish belief which they held to the most tenacity, and that is the observance of the Sabbath. What is the one thing the Jew feared to break? The Sabbath. And almost all but one of the apostles were Jewish. They worshipped on the last day, Saturday. They reverenced it. The Jew feared the breaking of that one day. Because one thing, they'd been sent into exile, their grandparents and everything, for years because of not keeping the Sabbath. And yet something happened to the small band of Jews that turned their lives upside down after their leader had been crucified. And they changed worship from Saturday to Sunday, to the first day of the week in honor of Jesus Christ as Messiah and the resurrection. I believe that we have, taking in the psychological implications here, one of the greatest decisions ever made in a part of an ethnic group. I really believe it. If you figure out what was going through their mind that they thought would happen if they were wrong, what God Jehovah would do to them, you probably have one of the greatest decisions ever made to change worship from Saturday to Sunday. And we have all these here. And I think as we weigh the situation and we look at all that took place here before and after, one would have to come to the conclusion that tomb was empty and Jesus was seen alive. Now they say the disciples stole the body. We have the problem of the breaking of the seal. We have a problem of all the appearances to more than 500 people at one time, especially to Thomas, the empiricist, the logical positivist. You have the problem of the stone, the grave clothes, the guards unit. Then you just have a moral and ethical problem. For the apostles to do that, that would mean they went against everything that their master taught them, ethically and morally. Everything. The exact opposite. And yet these men went out and died for it. Cowards and martyrs are not made out of the same material. Some people would say that there were hallucinations. Hallucinations. Now, could these accounts have been hallucinations? Well, one, in evidence that demands a verdict, it lists from medical sources the various ingredients of a hallucination. For example, hallucinations are very individualistic. These are seen by 500 people one time. Hallucinations usually go on and on and on. They don't stop at a certain time, but these appearances of Jesus stop just like that at his ascension. Hallucinations are brought about by people who are a little emotionally unstable and they're anticipating something, like a son coming home from war. The apostles weren't anticipating the resurrection at all. Man, they thought Jesus was, you know, the dead truth about Easter. Jesus. Hallucinations? What about the empty tomb? Well, the Jews and the Romans had to do was go get the body, and that'd been it. All they had to do was put the body in a cradle, march it down through the city of Jerusalem, and they'd kill Christianity, not in a cradle, but in the womb. Christianity is a bodiless religion. Hallucinations? What about the guards? What happened to them? Impossible hallucinations. Others would say that the Romans or the Jews took the body of Christ to put it in a secure place. Well, that sounds good. They'd say they put it in a secure place to keep from any deception. But why would they do the very thing that would cause all the problems they didn't want to have? An empty tomb. If the Jews or the Romans knew where the body was or what happened to it, why didn't they produce it? Because you see, the apostles here again went right back to Jerusalem. Why didn't they say, hey, just a minute, man. We moved it. Or we put it over here. Or as I said before, put it in a cradle, march it right down through the center of Jerusalem. It would have killed Christianity. There would have been no Christianity with a body. None whatsoever. But no, what did they do? They arrested the apostles, they beat them, they flogged them and threatened them with death. If they did not stop saying what they were saying, all they had to do was produce the body. I put it this way. The silence of the Jews speaks louder than the voice of the Christians. I really believe that. That the silence of the Jews, or at least it speaks as loud as the voice of the Christians on the empty tomb and the whereabouts of the body. Now, these here now are two theories that were presented in universities where my wife and I taught this last year or spoke. And some of them are really funny. I have to psych myself up for it. This one's really cool. The women went to the wrong tomb. No, really? It was taught in a university. In fact, it's been taught in many universities where I've been. The women went to the wrong tomb. They were a little frustrated. It was kind of early in the morning, a little dark. And they got a little mixed up. And they were a little scared. And they went to the wrong tomb. Well, then, I guess that means the men went to the wrong tomb. Then the Jews went to the wrong tomb. Then the Romans went to the wrong tomb. I mean, that's not even faith, that's credulity. I mean, you'd have to turn your back on everything. Then you got all the appearances. But then others would say, you can throw quite a few into this. It's what I call the swoon theory. Jesus really didn't die. He just swooned. There was a great loss of blood, and he passed out. Now this is what this theory would have to say. And it's really supernatural. Anyone studying with a modern approach to history would have to refute it or reject it because of its supernatural character. What they'd have to say is Jesus went through three trials, not one, three. Two Roman, one Jewish. He was beaten beyond description. He was so weak. And I got to this point, one university, and the guy says, yeah, but he carried his cross. I said, no, he didn't. He was so weak he couldn't carry his own crossbar. They took and drove spikes into his hands and his feet, and the cross was raised up and dropped into the ground. He was crucified. Didn't kill him. The guard came along, and one of them thrust a spear into his side. And even the eyewitness said blood and water came out, separated, sign of death. But in this case, I guess it was Jesus Christ superstar. Didn't kill him. They took him down. Four professional executioners signed his death warrant. They were all mistaken. They wrapped him 100-some pounds of aromatic spice and linen cloth. I guess he just breathed through it all. Put him into a damp tomb. They used the word damp tomb. Rolled a 1.5-2-ton stone against the entrance. Put the Roman seal on it and placed a Roman guard there. Now the amazing thing took place. Now this is the only way I know how to explain. The damp tomb, instead of killing him, healed him. And he kind of jumped up, hobbled over to the stone, pushed it out of the way, tied the guard up with a linen cloth, appeared to his disciples as Lord of life, was never pitied, was never ministered unto, but ministered unto others. And men went out and died for him. No wonder David Strauss, one of the greatest opponents of anything supernatural, miraculous in the Bible, says that no one could really believe that. And he's not even a Christian. Of course, Strauss really couldn't come to the conclusion what did take place, but he said no one can believe that could take place. Jesus Christ is alive. Professor Grant at the University of Chicago said the origin of Christianity is almost incomprehensible unless such an event took place, the resurrection. He said there's no other way to understand Christianity apart from the resurrection. That's the whole basis of it. Jesus Christ is alive. Now tonight, this has been very brief. Believe me, it's been brief. We could go back over each one of these points. We could just go back to the history and spend hours on that. We could go back to each one of these points and develop it before and after. We could go to each theory and develop it. But time wouldn't allow. But what I'd like you to do by Friday to read the chapter in the resurrection very carefully and keep these two columns in mind as you read through. Now, it's a long chapter. There's a lot of information there. There's about 25 lectures there I think 20 people could go to that chapter and come up with 20 different lectures on the resurrection. There's so much material there. But I want you to read through it carefully. It's the crux of Christianity. Jesus Christ is alive. And I ought to know. December the 19th, 1959, at 8:39, second year in the university, I became a Christian. And in 6 months to a year to a year and a half, Jesus Christ totally transformed my life. I am walking evidence that Jesus Christ is alive.